From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a former policy advisor to Robert Kennedy describes what he sees as the criminalization of poverty in America. Then one scientist looks at competing views of the impact of a proposed golf course development in Kohler.
It's pretty clear that there's a disconnect between the reality of what's going on and what is being revealed in the impact analysis statement.
Plus, critic Dave Beagle helps us go over the latest series of fall openings on stages around Milwaukee. And when Madison Children's Book author Dean Robbins saw a picture of NASA scientist Margaret Hamilton next to a stack of computer code, he had the idea for his latest book.
When I discovered Margaret Stoddard, she was a very obscure figure, and her signature achievement had happened in the late 60s and early 70s, and she'd pretty much lived in obscurity since then.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North. A report earlier this year from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance estimated that Wisconsin's prison population will hit a record level by 2019. The number of inmates had fallen somewhat since it reached its high point of over 23,000 a decade ago, but it has risen again in recent years. The nonpartisan group says harsher penalties are largely to blame. But the issue of overcrowded prisons and jails exists around the country, and writer Peter Edelman says the real phenomenon going on is the criminalization of poverty. Edelman teaches law at Georgetown University and was a former policy advisor to Robert Kennedy. Edelman's new book is called Not a Crime to Be Poor, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich.
Give us some historical perspective here. You write about the era of debtors' prisons and almshouses, and we don't have institutions with those names today. But how do you see the current paradigm resembling what we'd seen in the past?
Well, we're doing it. Turns out we're doing it. We kind of woke up to it, I think, around the country when Ferguson happened, Ferguson, Missouri, because there was the terrible tragedy of the murder or the killing of Michael Brown. But when people started taking a look at it, they discovered that the way the little city there was surviving, was getting its money, was by abusing its own residents with these crazy fines and fees. And then the New York Times, other journalists around the country started poking in and discovering that it's all really all over the country.
Right, Ferguson is not unique.
Yeah, and so you can't pay the fine. They throw you in the jail, and there you have the debtor's prison.
What set these wheels into motion? Because it was not always the case.
You know, what happened is starting in the Reagan period, we all know, and we just didn't sort of think about it in relation to the fines and fees, that there was this fight against taxes, the anti-tax rebellion. And the part that we didn't know as much about unless we got hit on it ourselves was that particularly in the courts, and I think that they probably talked to each other at their national meetings and so on, and they said, oh, what a good idea that we can just take these fines and take them up to the sky and fees for anything that has nothing to do with whatever they are alleged to have done. And it became this cash cow.
Essentially, the offenders are paying for the criminal justice system.
Absolutely. You go and have to pay for your driver's license. Why shouldn't you have to pay, let's say, to stay in the jail? Well, of course, it's not the same thing, but that's what they did.
You write a lot about a particular Supreme Court case that is supposed to preclude indigent people from being sent to jail because they can't afford to pay their fines. I suspect, though, that most people are not familiar with Bearden versus Georgia. What can you tell us about that case?
The case says that if they're you're guilty of a fine, if the way it's written is it only allows for fines, and if they decide that you're not paying and they put you in jail anyway, Bearden says that's unconstitutional. And so we have particularly municipal judges all over the country who often are not even lawyers, and they may not even know about Bearden. And then a lot of them have quaint, colorful criteria for whether you're able to pay. So they say to the person, well, you have a nice tattoo, you can pay. Oh, you have nice shoes, you can pay. And this literally happens, and it happens across the country. One of the places that I was struck with was Benton County in the state of Washington, which is, you know, rather far away from the places you would expect of Georgia,
right,
Alabama.
We think of Washington State as a kind of progressive sort of state.
Yes, yeah. Now, it does happen to be all the way the other end of the state, and it's a different politics and everything. But still, it's the state of Washington, which we think of as a blue place.
Well, and I guess there are also ways that they can get around Bearden versus Georgia. Even if they hew to that line, there are other ways of sending people to prison that don't necessarily contradict it.
Absolutely, and it's still terrible public policy. But all they have to do, and of course, many of them have figured this out. So they say to the person, you're guilty, we understand you can't pay, we'll give you a payment plan. And I saw this I was down in New Orleans and saw it operating. And so then when you can't pay, they come after you. And by the way, during that period of time that you're quote-unquote on probation, they're charging you $40 a month to be on probation. 13 states have that for profit, but actually public probation agencies do that around the country. And then it piles up because they miss a payment, they miss when they're supposed to go to court, there's a bench warrant, they're brought in again. Now they're guilty of criminal contempt, not a constitutional problem. One of the problems that goes with all of this is that there aren't enough lawyers. And particularly in the small towns, they're, even though there's a constitutional right to have, because this is a criminal thing, they're just not there. Or if they are there, they actually work for the judge. They're on a contract, and they're really not there to help the defendant.
Right, and the cliche is, you know, if you do not have an attorney, you cannot afford one, one will be appointed for you. But you write that even in the case of court-appointed lawyers, sometimes people are paying fairly astronomical fees to be represented, even by a public defender.
It's shocking. NPR did a study of this and found that 43 states in this country do have fees to have a public defender. And some of them really get up to high numbers. It makes no sense, but it does exist.
So the incentive for states to do this is what? Why would a state say that the costs involved in incarcerating so many people are worth it?
The way in which the quote-unquote smart ones do have a sort of a lower cost thing. Do it in a way where you don't lock up people because that costs money. Just squeeze them. You know, just take the money out of their paycheck. Take the refund of the tax refund. Maybe use some debt collectors, although that costs a little bit of money. So with the high fines and fees, there's some people who can pay. I can pay. I think it's outrageous, but if it happened to me, I could pay. And then the other thing to understand is that there are a lot of people who really basically can't do it, but between their whole family, they can squeeze themselves in terrible ways where they don't pay the rent, they don't pay the utility bill, they sell their plasma in order to make sure. And very often their loved one has never gotten out of jail because has been arrested and put money bail that they have to come up with, $500, $1,000. They can't do it, and they sit there. And what happens is they finally, if the family can't come up with the money, they plead guilty. And then as a consequence of pleading guilty, they all owe all this money, even though they're not guilty of anything. And then this whole thing that I already said takes place where they're just stuck. So that's the kind of and money bail plays a very, very big role in all of this. And that's not just about the fines and fees.
What would you say, though, to people who might say that, this is a situation, a problem that so many poor people are trapped in the cycle, but what should our approach be to at least ensuring that people who do break laws are sanctioned in some way for, doing so?
This is a somewhat fair question, because so many of these things shouldn't be criminal at all. They should be, if anything, civil violations. That's one thing. But we really need simplification all up and down. For people who've done terrible things, then they should be sentenced for long periods of time. But there's so many things where we're over-sentencing, even on the felony side. And so if you look at California and Proposition 47, which was a ballot initiative, they're doing that decarceration out there. And there's making smaller the number of people who are held in the prisons and in the jails. So the answer to the question is yes, even on the smaller things, there are appropriate things that are misdemeanors, yes. But then the next question is, what's the proper fine for that? What's this putting all the thing about the law library and all this other stuff? And in Oklahoma, they have 15 different fees that they attach on to the fine, and it has nothing to do with what they supposedly did. So even there, it's one thing to say we have to have a certain number of these things as a matter of kind of people obeying the law. That's not what we're doing here.
Right, you're not contending that someone who is poor gets a pass for DUI or passing a false check or running a red light, just that the punishment is appropriate.
Yeah, fits the crime.
So there are a lot of problems you write about, but you also write about some solutions, including some going on just to the south of here. Can you talk about the work that's going on, say, in Chicago, that's aimed at reversing these trends?
This is on the complete other turn the coin over. The positive, the building in the positive direction. There's a place called the Logan Square Neighborhood Association in Chicago, which is 100 years old. It was a settlement. It was the people that it served were Eastern European immigrants then. And time has passed, and it's a Latino community now. And they do multiple things, but the thing that got my eye, somebody told me about it, and I went out to see them. Seven places around the country I did this. They have this absolutely wonderful program that's called the Parent Mentor Program. And they get these young, these moms, when their kids are in kindergarten, and they get them to come to school with their kids, and they get paid a little bit of money, and the teachers were skeptical at first, but it turns out they're really helpful in the classroom. And then from that, because it's all structured very well, many of them go on and get more education. Some of them actually end up being teachers. People work for the organization. Some of them become community organizers. So it's a whole frame of community building and supporting families, and it's just exactly one of the things that we need to do.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you about your own connection to this work, which goes all the way back to your time as an advisor to then-Senator Robert Kennedy. How did that period shape your interest in this field today?
Well, specifically on what the book is about, it's actually new to me. I've been working on these things, as you said, since I worked with Robert Kennedy, and he's certainly my inspiration. And I have been, ever since we lost him, I learned from him, and we together, I of course, trying to be helpful to him, around the country to see and do something about the poverty in our country. And so I made it kind of my business and a variety of things that I've done to work on that. And then we come to Ferguson, and I'm like, what's that? That's something I didn't know about that. And so it took me into writing this book.
Does it amaze you that many of the same issues that you were working on 50 years ago are issues that we are still trying to get right today?
We should be very clear that we've done a lot of good things. Poverty went down in the 60s. We got down to 11% in 1973 from twice that a few years earlier. And we have held, despite all of the deindustrialization, which certainly here in Milwaukee and across the Rust Belt, people are quite familiar with that, about which we have not done enough. But we did a lot of things in terms of Social Security, in terms of earned income tax credit, food stamps, a whole bunch of things. And the fact is that we would have twice as many people who are poor as we have, the 43 million that we have, if we hadn't done these things. So people say none of that stuff works. There's a congressman from your state there, Paul Ryan, by name, who keeps on telling us that none of us that work. It's absolutely wrong. So why do we still have 43 million people? These are new issues, although the bottom line is about jobs that get you an adequate income, and we're still struggling about having the kind of education system that we want, because the what we could do in the 50s when we had industrial plants and you didn't have to graduate from high school, and you were still working as a union member, and you could do well, and your kids could go to college. Well, that's all changed. So the effort now is to respond to today's challenges, and that's the jobs, but it's also mass incarceration, and it's also the things that I wrote about in this book.
Well, Peter Edelman, it has been a great pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Peter Edelman is a professor of law at Georgetown University, a former policy advisor to Senator Robert Kennedy, and he's the author of the new book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. He was in Milwaukee yesterday for an event at Boswell Book Company in partnership with Community Advocates Public Policy Institute. Coming up next, we'll talk with one environmental impact analyst about a proposed golf course in Kohler. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. The Kohler Company in Kohler, Wisconsin, has a long history of contributing to the state's economy and its green space. In the 1960s, the company donated land along Lake Michigan, just south of Sheboygan, which became Kohler-Andre State Park. Today, it's among Wisconsin's favorite recreational destinations. Now Kohler Company wants to build a golf course just above the park on property it owns. That plan pleases some, and it worries others, especially those who live closest to the site. The project is moving through the permitting process, and it requires that environmental impacts be considered. The DNR has drafted such a report and is holding a public hearing in Sheboygan this evening. Quentin Carpenter has closely scrutinized that DNR document. The wetlands expert was contracted to review the golf course plan by Friends of the Black River Forest. That's a citizens group which is concerned about the impact the proposed golf course would have on the surrounding wetlands. Carpenter shares some of his takeaways from the draft environmental impact statement with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz.
What stands out in my mind is the disconnect between what the field reports from the consultant staff and from the DNR staff say versus what the summary comments are. The summary comments are just absolutely vague and full of what I call weasel words. It may eventually do this. It might happen, could increase the potential for damage. They basically don't say anything, whereas the information supplied is that this is a unique site. It certainly would qualify for a very high status, a state natural area, just like the Kohler-Andre piece that's next to it. In fact, probably the wetlands on the piece in question are probably better than the ones that continue right south into the park property. So this is it's very, very clear from all of the field reports that this is a really special site.
You're saying that there's material within this draft environmental impact statement that signal the importance of this area, but that information is then not reflected in the summary. Is that right?
There's a little bit in the summary that kind of factually says that this is highly rated. But then the summary pretty much just looks at the very narrow, okay, it's going to take this many wetlands out of so many wetlands that are present. Mostly it just says it's going to require a permit for this, a permit for that. We know that already. It's clearly trying to avoid the hard truth that this is going to be a major impact that's going to change the complete nature of the site. How do you go to a site, remove 50% of the trees? It's no longer the same type of forest. It's going to be openings. If you want to see what it looked like, you just go to Google Earth and see what it looks like today and then look at the figure that shows what it will look like when it's finished. It has some of the contours, but that's about what's left. This site has a set of relic dunes, with the most recent ones having wetlands still in them, and then there are lots of scattered wetlands here and there along that side. But the golf course, that's where the rare wetlands are.
So, Quinton, the public hearing that will take place gives people the opportunity to comment on the wetland permit, which I believe the DNR has already tentatively is on the verge of permitting, as well as this draft EIS. And I read just in the preface to the EIS document that the purpose of an EIS is to inform decision makers and the public about alternative courses of action and the anticipated effects of those alternatives on the quality of the human environment that could result from department actions. Do you think
that's what I taught the students? But it's certainly not the case here. Yes, I mean, the purpose of the EIS is solely for providing information and predictions. And one of the more hilarious things in the report is right at the end where the DNR, where they say, quote, there is a low degree of risk and uncertainty in predicting environmental effects, as the analysis has relied on the expertise of department professionals who have evaluated numerous major development projects. So they're saying that they feel very confident in predicting the environmental effects. But if you read up above, they really don't predict anything. Someone reading it would not get the sense of what is going to happen. The ridges are going to be graded down and smooth. You can't play on the top of a dune. You can't put a road there. You can't put a golf court path there. That's going to spread them out toward the wetlands that are on the edges. There's supposed to be some little filter strips that are supposed to catch everything before it gets down to the groundwater and then flows into the wetlands, but that is so close that that's hardly realistic. Any person who has experience with it can see that in a few years, all of the wetlands on the lakeside are likely to be degraded. And there may still be wetlands there, but they won't look much like the ones that are there now that have 40, 50, 60 species in them. These ridge and swale wetlands are classified by DNR, by the federal government, as rare and threatened wetlands. And this is one of the better examples and probably the best example in southern Wisconsin. So that's the situation, is that there's a major development right on the edge of the most fragile wetlands that you could think of. And the predictions from the soil people is that stuff will run through. These sandy soils, soils are 98% sand, so anything that gets into them just goes right down. The groundwater, in many places, the groundwater is only 1, 2, 3, 4 feet below the surface, so there isn't like you've got a long time to have something filtered out or to change it. It's pretty clear that there's a disconnect between the reality of what's going on and what is being revealed in the impact analysis statement. And that's most unfortunate.
So what one should anticipate or what one looks for in an environmental impact process, if this percent of wetlands or the forest are can anticipate these impacts?
The major purpose is to predict the effects on the environment. And then people can make the decision, okay, we're going to trade off this value for economic value or for some public use value, as in a highway or something. But if you don't truly reveal the likely consequences of the action, then the process is not working, because when the summaries don't match the data, there's a problem. because what most of the regulators are going to read is just the summary statements. And take a look at them, and you can see that they just don't say much for such a major project. I mean, we're talking mutual millions and supposed large economic benefits, which others can comment on that. But it's also very clear that there will be detrimental effects on the wetlands. I mean, golf courses are unnatural creatures that have to stay green during the playing season, so they have to be constantly, just like people's lawns, have to be watered and fed. This site is essentially closer to a desert than anything else around here because it's all sand. And it currently, when it rains, it gets a little green, and when it gets midsummer, it turns brown. It's also mostly forested, but it's a thin forest, so that a lot of light gets through. There are suitability ratings of soils for golf courses, and these are rated as severely limited in compatibility with golf courses. There's absolutely no mention of that in the summary statements.
Quentin Carpenter is a wetlands expert and retired UW-Madison senior lecturer. He shared his take on the environmental impact report drafted by the Wisconsin DNR for the proposed Kohler Golf Course along Lake Michigan in Sheboygan County. Carpenter was hired by Friends of the Black River Forest, a group concerned about the proposed golf course, to review the draft. The DNR is holding a public hearing this evening at the University of Wisconsin, Sheboygan. We did reach out to the Kohler Company for comment. A spokesperson told us the team is, quote, very busy and not able to meet with you, unquote. However, Dirk Willis with Kohler did share this statement with us that reads in part, Kohler Company is pleased to reach this major milestone in the ongoing review of our public golf course project and remains committed to following the appropriate process as we move the project forward. You can read Kohler's full statement and learn more about the entire project at WUWM.com. Coming up next, theater critic Dave Beagle shares some thoughts about the latest productions on stages around Milwaukee when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Earlier this year, we started an occasional series of conversations with local theater critic Dave Beagle about shows on stage around Wisconsin and the bigger theater picture. The second round of theater openings this fall season have either just occurred or are about to, and Dave Beagle joins us in the studio again. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Bonnie North.
How are you? Did you have a great turkey day?
It was a good turkey day, yeah. We had, I carved, and we had a lot of people, a lot of family, friends.
Family and
nice.
Friends came
yeah.
over, yeah.
yeah. Nice.
And I understand you just celebrated a big anniversary, too.
50 years my wife has put up with me.
I'm impressed. Did she get a medal?
No, but she's got a spot in heaven. There's no doubt
yeah.
about that. If you believe in a heaven, she's there.
She's there.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations
Thank
on
you.
That. That
Thank
is
you.
That is a terrific anniversary.
Thank you.
But we are not here to talk about anniversaries or turkey, even, although there might be some turkeys.
There might be. There's a little turkey.
A little turkey.
Yeah.
But we're talking about theater. This is like number three or four of our conversations about mm-hmm. what's going on stage and backstage in Milwaukee. And
Which leads us right
into something that you and I both talked about kind of separately, you writing and me actually interviewing the person who created mm-hmm. this, intimacy choreography.
Right.
And this was on stage, on view in a recent Renaissance Theater production.
Sex with Strangers.
Sex
right.
with Strangers.
Starring Marty
Goble
and Nick Narcisi and directed by arguably one of my all-time favorite directors is young Mallory Matoxin, just absolutely brilliant young woman.
And two really great actors.
Two great actors.
And the whole idea, for people who may not have heard the original interview that I had with Tonia Senia, who was the creator of this, the idea is that intimacy on stage for the safety of everyone should be choreographed much like fights are choreographed on stage. So you don't have people waving swords around and accidentally poking someone's eye out. You know, the idea is that when you are staging sex, that it needs to be done in such a way that everybody feels safe. So what's your problem with it? Because you did have a problem with it.
I did have a problem with it.
Is it the thing itself or the way it was done?
Well, you know, I'm not unalterably opposed to intimacy choreography. But having said that, this play just fell flat because when they had the and sex was there's a lot of intimacy. I mean, it's at the heart of the story.
I was going to say it's in
the
title.
Heart of the play.
Yeah,
and it looks so mechanical. You know, I mean, theater is a small place. You know, I mean, it's a small place, and you can see everything. It looked like they were doing it by the numbers. Like, you know, I've got a number 4 here. You put your hand on her butt. Number 3, you kiss. His mouth is a little open. Yours is closed. No tongue. You know, I mean, it was like, holy cow, this is
so and sex it, by the numbers. Essentially,
it brought the whole play down. And here's where I have some difficulty with this. As I say, the philosophy behind it's okay. Throughout the history of theater, and I've been involved in theater for 60 years. Men and women getting together, women and women, men and men getting together in theater productions is as old as time. There's not much you're going to change about that. I have done any number of kissing scenes and hugging scenes with women actors over the years. I've never had anybody choreograph them. I've never had any of these relationships ever got out of hand. You approach it as professionals. I think most actors today, most, not all, will tell you, we can do this. We know how to do this. We know how to act like we're in love with each other and having a passionate moment on stage without having somebody choreograph it. Having said that, there are indeed cases, and there have been some very notable cases, especially in Chicago theater, where the rehearsal process of intimacy scenes has extended past the rehearsal time period, and men have been very, very aggressive and placed women actors in uncomfortable positions. Now, I suppose that intimacy choreography is clearly one answer to that problem. I'm not sure it's the only answer to that problem, but it's one answer to the problem. If you're going to do it, it's okay, I guess, to do it. But, boy, it's a risk. I mean, I really think you're taking risks. At the same time that Renaissance ran Sex with Strangers, Chamber Theater was running Frank and Johnny and the Clair de Lune. And, I mean, we had full nudity for both Todd Denning and Marcy Kearns in that one. And there was a lot of intimacy, and there was no intimacy choreography. But, boy, you watched it, and you thought, these people are into each other right now. I mean, it pulled you in, whereas in the other one, it pushed you away.
Do you think that that has to do with the choreography itself or maybe the chemistry with the actors? I'm not saying one or the other, but it seems to me that you... You know, in the way that you wouldn't throw people on stage with swords. And sometimes I have seen fight scenes on stage that look very mechanical. You can tell they're going, oh, okay, I have to parry here and I have to do this. But when they work, they're breathless.
I think the point of intimacy choreography is to remove the element of chemistry. It takes the chemistry out of it. Do you and I have chemistry? Can you and I kiss on stage and make it seem real? Well, we're not going to bother finding out whether you really have chemistry. We're going to show you how to do it step by step, and that's what's going to happen. Marty Goebel is, as you well know, is a passionate woman and a passionate actor. When she sinks her teeth into a role, boy, there's no doubt that she is who she is. She looked like an unimpassioned person in the older woman in this play. I mean, it took the teeth out of her role, and it was just that stuff. You know, a phrase I hate to use is political correctness, but I'm going to use it a little bit here. I think that that response, this kind of field that Tonya has created, who you did a great interview with, is a little bit of a, it's almost like too much of a solution in search of too little a problem. I don't think the problem is that big, first of all. I know actors, I've been in dozens and dozens of plays where there have been kisses. I did Merchant of Venice, where Mark Metcalf and Grant Goodman, who is at the Rep right now, had to French kiss each other on stage. And David Chambers, the director, said, you know, you guys work it out. And they worked it out just fine. Nobody was after each other, but, you know, they did it.
Right.
Actors do this.
I know. And I agree with you, and there's a certain professional, but... You know, a lot of what her work is focused on is in the academic setting as people are getting trained. And when you have very young actors, you know, they are susceptible to being taken advantage of, men and women. I mean, because you want to be a star. You want the part. You want the role. And so I see a place for it. I think it's important that people feel that they're not going to be taken advantage of. Maybe there's a compromise that can be made where there's a little bit of some of what is put out there is like, you know, we're going to choreograph this because it's particularly thorny. It's a really difficult scene. The rest of it we'll figure out, but let's work on this. And so maybe that would be the answer.
I think that's part of the answer. I also think, let's see if we got a problem before we have an answer. You know, you might put two actors on stage and they might hit it off right away. I mean, they've got it. They know how to kiss on stage. It looks like a real kiss. I don't need any.
And they're okay with each other.
And they're okay
offstage.
With each other. And nobody's worried about it. Nobody's.
Right.
I mean, if you want to do choreography, I would rather to avoid elements of sexual harassment, I'd rather do choreography for the audition process. I think there's a hell of a lot more discomfort felt by women when they audition for plays than there is when they're on stage being kissed by a male actor. I really do. I just say.
Needs to start earlier.
It needs to start a lot earlier. Right. If I'm a teacher at a college level teaching an acting course, I want to have a course that teaches women actors especially how to be safe during the entire audition
and
process.
And to teach male actors not to take advantage, or directors.
Yeah, directors, I mean, often it's casting directors.
Exactly.
Those people, you know. I
exactly.
Mean, that's where the real crimes are. But anyhow.
All right. So we have a whole bunch of plays because there's a lot of stuff that opened since the last time you and I talked, starting with what I understand, because I haven't seen it yet, a fabulous production of Annie.
Molly Rohde, the artistic director at Northern Sky Theater and a familiar name in Milwaukee, is one of the most perfect directors for shows like this that I've ever seen. I mean, she did A Sound of Music 5 years ago at Skylight. I've probably seen that play 20 times. It was the best I've ever seen, including Broadway productions. She's a genius. And she took this play, and they got a couple darling young girls who play Annie, and they had the incredible, growing ever more incredible each time I see him, Andrew Varela as Daddy Warbucks. I mean, it's a production that is spectacular. These kids, the orphans, are spectacular. There was a moment in this play when the orphans were doing a song, not Hard Knock Life, but they were doing another song and dance, and the audience spontaneously sprang to their feet and started clapping. You're looking for a holiday production. That's a holiday production that you don't want to miss, and there are a couple other great holiday productions going on. Of course, Christmas Carol is going to open soon. The second year of the Mark Clements adaptation, we'll see what changes he made. That's always a popular thing. So we've got that. We've got Charlie Brown Christmas. If I had to pick one Christmas show to take my family to, it would be a Charlie Brown Christmas at First Stage. It is without a doubt.
They do this kind of thing so well.
Oh, God, do they do this well. I mean, there's a reason that people come from all, people who want to start children's theater companies come from all over the world to see what they do here. And they've changed their name from children's theater to family theater. And it's really apropos because everybody's going to enjoy this. I mean, I sat there with two of my grandkids. I loved the play just as much as they did. You know, I mean, they're fantastic. And Matt Daniels delivers a performance for the ages as Snoopy. I mean, he's absolutely wonderful. Chamber Theater also has a play called Miracle on South Division Street. It's about a Polish family in Buffalo, New York, and a historic familial story about Christmas. And there's some really good actors in it. I mean, Greta Wohlrabi, Kat Woodkey's in it, Joshua French, and it's a great performance of a lousy play. I hate to say it. It's a play. It's like a one-joke play. It's like stand-up comedy. Everything leads up to one joke. You hear the joke. It leads up to another joke. You hear the joke. And it's too bad because I think the concept behind the thing is really pretty good.
So it sounds like it's the play that you...
It's not the performance. Everything... I mean, the set's fantastic. Michael Wright does a great job directing. The actors are good. It's just not a great play.
Okay.
You know? And hard to overcome that. Two other things that I want to get to before we go. One is Holmes and Watson at the Rep, which is really, I mean, it's really worth seeing. It's as interesting a play as you'll see this year, something totally unexpected. I mean, I went in, and I'm rarely really, really surprised. This one surprised me from beginning to end. Two great Milwaukee actors, Mark Corkins and Norman Moses, are in it. and
kind of the leads.
They are definitely the leads. They're definitely the leads. There's no doubt about it. And they're terrific. And the other great Milwaukee actor and performance you can't miss is Secret Mask at Next Act. I've probably seen Jim Pickering in 100 plays over the years, maybe more. I have never seen him like this. It is a performance for the absolute ages. He's a man who suffered a stroke, and there's some residual effect in his son, who he hasn't seen in 40 years, who walked out and comes in. It's their relationship. It's a definite father-son show, but it's also a mother-daughter show. It's about the relationship between a parent and a child, and when they drift apart and they come together, and what it takes to keep that relationship going. It's a spectacular.
So it's a don't miss.
It's a don't miss for Pickering, and Tammy Workentine's in it as well, and this new guy, Drew Parker, who I've never seen before, lives in California. David Cesarini got him in to do this. It's a terrific play.
So lots to see.
There's a lot to see, a lot to see.
Dave Beagle, it's always great to talk with you. We're going to catch up before Christmas, or we're going to wait until
after? We're going to wait until after Christmas.
All right.
I think the year will turn.
And then we'll have new things to
talk about.
And I'll
get back together.
Sounds good. We'll have a happy holiday.
Thank you, Bonnie.
And we'll see you in 2018.
Thank you, Dan. Bye-bye.
Dave Beagle is a longtime Milwaukee theater critic. He joins us every so often to share his thoughts on shows and trends on the stages around the region. You can find links to his reviews at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then Madison writer Dean Robbins shares the somewhat overlooked story of a pioneering NASA computer scientist. The story of Margaret Hamilton is next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. A few weeks ago, we introduced you to Kathy Sullivan, a pioneer among astronauts. Sullivan flew on 3 space shuttle missions and was the first woman to walk in space. She was in town earlier this year to talk about her book for young readers. But before Kathy Sullivan walked in space, another pioneering woman helped ensure that there was a successful space program. Margaret Hamilton's story had gone largely unnoticed for decades until relatively recently. Like with Sullivan, a new children's book tells Hamilton's inspirational story. Margaret and the Moon is written by Madison author Dean Robbins, who joined Mitch Tyke on the line to tell us more about her story.
About 3 years ago, I noticed a photograph, an unusual photograph, that was making the rounds on the internet. This was a picture, a black and white photo, of a sort of ordinary-looking woman from the 1960s. She had long, straight hair and wire-rimmed glasses and one of those stylish dresses from the time. But the unusual thing was that she was standing next to a huge stack of paper that went all the way over her head. And you read the caption, and it said this was Margaret Hamilton, who was director of software engineering for NASA's Project Apollo. And at that point, you realized this was no ordinary woman. This was a computer genius who helped astronauts get all the way to the moon for the first time using the extremely limited technology of that era.
Well, and I imagine you, like many of us, upon seeing a photo like that, might have been amazed that there even was software engineering in those days, let alone that it was a woman leading it.
Exactly. And you don't associate women working for NASA back in the 1960s. I think people saw this photograph and were delighted to find out that a woman had played such a pivotal role. And I think they were amazed that they were ready for an indomitable female scientist like Margaret Hamilton.
Well, and the thing that amazes me about this is that even today, in an era that we think we know everything, that we've heard almost every story, there are still great stories just sitting in front of our faces waiting to be told.
Right, especially about women. I think women's contributions have not been recognized, and that's starting to change. When I discovered Margaret's photo, she was a very obscure figure, and her signature achievement had happened in the late 60s and early 70s. And she'd pretty much lived in obscurity since then. And I saw this picture. I decided to investigate for the possibility of writing a children's book about her, but I couldn't find any information. No one else had written a book about Margaret Hamilton. So I put on my journalist hat and I dug up a phone number and an address for her. And I contacted her and asked if she'd be willing to tell me her story for a children's book.
Well, and that's the other thing that struck me, because, you know, there are stories out there about pioneering and strong women like Amelia Earhart and Susan B. Anthony and Rosa Parks, and they all have in common that, by and large, these are historical figures who are no longer with us. Did it give you pause to portray someone who was still living and breathing?
Well, as a journalist, it was actually kind of exciting, because I'd written about Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass and Alice Paul, who were long-gone figures. Here was somebody that I could actually speak to. I was a little worried that she wouldn't be interested in talking to me. And in fact, I learned that Margaret is the opposite of a fame seeker. She's a very serious scientist with loads of integrity, and she could have easily said no. But luckily for me, she has grandchildren who are elementary school age. And she said that she was kind of tickled by the thought of a book that she could read to her grandkids, great-grandkids, about her life.
So that was really, I was going to ask, realizing that she would be the better person to answer this question. You sense that the idea of telling this story to a young audience in particular appealed to her?
Yeah, I think the key to Margaret Hambleton, I think, is her interest in problem solving. Ever since she was a little girl, she loved solving problems, whether math problems or philosophical problems or the problems that girls and women face in a sexist society. And I think that she likes the idea of young girls reading about somebody who went through this and maybe identifying with her and identifying with the strong female heroine.
How much time did you get to spend chatting with her as this book sort of came into focus for you?
Well, she really warmed up to the idea of giving me lots of information for the book. So we spoke on the phone several times, and we exchanged emails, and she shared all sorts of technical details about the work that she did. And as she was telling me all this stuff, I thought, well, this is way too complicated for an elementary school kid to understand. And I asked her if she could explain it in a way that maybe an 8-year-old might be able to comprehend. And she absolutely couldn't do that because she's not used to thinking of her work in that way. So it fell to me as an English major to simplify the story so in a way that young children might understand. And I was worried how Margaret would take that when she saw the final draft of the manuscript, but she was very magnanimous and told me that she thought that it had captured the spirit of her story.
Well, and we keep kind of talking around her story. Can you share what the real significant thing, you know, this picture of her next to the code, which is actually portrayed in the illustrations in your book, is really interesting. But there's this sort of little known or maybe little remembered aspect to the Apollo 11 mission that she played a huge role in. What was that? What was that?
Right. Well, I guess I should say first that she was a pioneering computer scientist at a time when there were very few women in that field. And she rose to director of software engineering for NASA's Project Apollo, helping to write the code that got astronauts all the way to the moon for the first time. And there was no roadmap for using computers in that way back then, but Margaret had to make up these solutions as she went along. So this signature achievement that you're talking about, which is the climax of Margaret and the moon, Apollo 11 mission was hurtling toward the moon, and the lunar module was about to land on the lunar surface. And all of a sudden, the spaceship's computer started to overload because the astronaut made a tiny mistake. And it looked like the lunar module might actually crash on the moon or might have to abort the mission. Well, Margaret Hamilton's brilliant computer programming saved the day. With her knack for anticipating problems, she had thought about what might happen if an astronaut did make a mistake and the computer started to overload. So she had programmed it in such a way that the computer would ignore all the extra tasks that were flooding in and just focus on the most important task, which was landing the spaceship on the moon. And that's what happened. And at that moment, she became a legend of the United States space program.
How tricky is portraying the historical context for this story when you're telling it for kids who grow up in an era of, you know, first of all, Title IX, and also at a time when, you know, there are many people telling girls and boys as well that they can grow up to become anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of elements to this story. There was the whole context of NASA, and there was the sexism of the 1960s and 70s. And the first draft of the manuscript I wrote was extremely long because there was so much to tell. And so it was really a process of paring away and getting down to the essence of the story and really focusing on what was most dramatic and important about Margaret's story. And I hope it turned out okay.
Right, yeah. I mean, kids today, you know, take it for granted that there are people, you know, orbiting the Earth at every moment in the International Space Station. And, you know, I wonder if it's an eye-opener to some of them that that it really was not all that long ago when it was pretty unusual to be able to put someone up in space.
Mm-hmm. When I visit schools, I tell the story about the effort to put people on the moon for the first time. And kids are moderately excited about this. When I get around at the end of my presentation to telling them that now there's a Margaret Hamilton Lego toy, that's what gets them extraordinarily excited. So that they can relate to.
For someone who was tickled to have her story told to a young audience, I imagine she must have been likewise tickled to have a Lego immortalize her.
I think she was. You know, I think she's kind of immune to that sort of celebrity thing, but I did see a picture of her posing with the Women of NASA Lego set, so at least part of her must have been excited about that. I know that when my son was young, there were no female figures in any of his Lego sets, so I think it's just so exciting that now NASA is paying all this attention to women heroines like Margaret Hamilton.
Can you talk about the illustrations in this book? Because they add another whole dimension to the story.
Oh, the illustrations are wonderful. So Lucy Nicely is a brilliant comics artist. She's written best-selling autobiographical graphic novels like Relish and Displacement. And she brought so much of her wry sensibility to the book. She also pulled off this tricky tone that I sort of had in mind from the start, which is that the book would be both playful and sort of cosmic. There's some of her illustrations just make me laugh out loud because they're so witty, and others are just absolutely sublime. Like she's got a 2-page spread of the young Margaret Hamilton just gazing up into the universe.
So, do you have any sense for how Margaret Hamilton's great grandchildren are taking to the story?
Well, she sent me a photograph of a friend's child reading Margaret and the Moon, so I think she's happy with it. I've also sent her pictures of kids at school visits that I've done dressed up as Margaret Hamilton and holding projects that they've done about Margaret Hamilton and her great work. And I think she's been really, really excited to see that.
Well, Dean Robbins, it is it's a story I knew very little about before reading Margaret and the Moon as well. So job well done.
Thank you. Thank you, Mitch.
Dean Robbins is a Wisconsin children's book author. His titles include Two Friends, Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass, Miss Paul and the President, and his latest, Margaret and the Moon. We reached him on the line from Madison. You can read more about the book at WUWM.com and also listen back to our interview with another pioneering woman at NASA, astronaut Kathy Sullivan. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It is 11 o'clock.